Hey, Jeff.
Yo.
So you interviewed Elisa Gabbert.
Elisa Gabbert, not Alyssa Gabbert, because years ago she read at my reading series and I was jawing at her, and one of the first things she said is it's Elisa, not Alyssa.
Well, I think Alyssa is usually spelled with an A and her name spelled with an E.
No. Alyssa Steamer, former professional skateboarder, Elissa.
Huh.
Elisa Gabbert, Elisa.
All right.
But Elisa Gabbert.
How did the what should we know about Elisa before we listen to your interview with her? Now that we know how to say her name.
Multiple things. I thought she was from the East Coast. She's actually from Texas, which kind of surprised me. She is a poet slash essayist, but published three collections of poetry initially, and had a blog that I don't think I didn't comment on it very much, but I used to. Her blog was called The French Exit before she made the. We talk a little bit about this before she made the move to Twitter, but. Again, in the late, what's the late tens? Like 2009?
The late aughts.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They call it aughts. I
Well,
don't
she
know
had a blog for a while, and so her husband John Cotter also used to do this online magazine called Open Letters Monthly, which is really good. But Elisa's most recently published a essay collection called The Word Pretty, which got her a lot of kind of deserved acclaim, and it's super, super good. And we jawed about topics from Ryan Adams to Interpol to OG kind of bands from, well, I guess not, I guess those both of them are still practicing.
Does the French exit, is that a term referring to something? Is it like it means you get away quickly from a conversation or something?
Yeah, you leave a party without saying bye to anyone.
Oh, I love that.
But then I feel like people say there's an Irish like I for every I
That's
it,
funny.
the French exit, that's how I've always understood it, that it's leaving. I don't think it's a conversation. It's more of like a social gathering. You just duck out without kind of, which is something that I would say I try and do now.
I love that. Oh, I've been doing that for a long time and I didn't know there's a name for it. I just thought of it as self-care.
How is it self-care not to say
Cuz
bye to
I
people?
have social anxiety and then I have to go around saying bye to everybody. It's like, "Oh, this is too much. I just need to go."
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, well, that was the title of her first collection of poems too, and her OG blog.
Did
But
you ask if she was mad that Patrick DeWitt titled his book also The French Exit?
I didn't.
Yeah.
She's into perfume.
Huh. Do you guys talk about that?
No, but I meant to ask her about it.
Oh.
We talked about a whole bunch of other stuff, which you're going to hear in a second.
How do you know she's into perfume?
Because through that blog, and I
Oh,
think
that
she's
makes
written
sense.
essays on it. I
All
think,
right.
yeah, actually, I believe there's an essay in The Word Pretty about it.
Okay.
There, I could be lying about that, but she's into scents.
Good. All
Yeah,
right.
good talk.
That was great.
Elisa Gabbert.
Yay. Welcome to the steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like,
The good intonation?
well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this.
Sick of
Elisa. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Well, so one of the things, okay, Alyssa, remember back in the day? In 2011, you read at a reading series I did.
The clean part?
The clean part reading series.
That's a blast from the past.
Right? And you read actually with Joshua Ware. Lily Brown couldn't make it.
Right. I remember.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
And we had dinner at the Blue Orchid. You, me, and John.
You ordered a Tom Collins.
Did I? I think you're right.
I think you were in a phase of that's what you were drinking, Tom Collins's.
Yeah, I have like a sugar thing. So I guess I'm curious, because I kind of to prep, I reread a lot of your stuff. And you, well, one of the things in the word pretty, that rereading gives you mortal anxiety. Why?
Because I just start thinking about how short life is, and there's so many books I haven't read. So if I spend the time I could be using reading a new book, reading a book I've already read, it's like I'm wasting my life. I'm going to die soon.
Is that really what goes through your head?
Yeah, 100%.
No matter what it is, though.
Well, I mean, I could reread a poem or something.
Sure.
You know? That wouldn't take very long. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a slow reader. So if I was going to reread a whole novel, I would feel like that's a week of my life. That's like one less book I can read before I die.
Okay, so that's very one less book I can read before I die. But what happens if you can't sleep? Do you go back to things? I mean, like I read Roman history.
In bed?
Well, if
to
I can't.
To try to put yourself to sleep?
If I can't sleep, I read, you know, Mary Beard.
Mm-hmm.
I read her because it kind of puts me to sleep. I like it too, but
yeah.
It gives me, I guess, existential dread in a good way.
Oh, I don't really read in the middle of the night, so.
But if you can't sleep, you still don't?
If I can't sleep, I'll just lie in bed and think sometimes for hours. And then if it gets to be like dawn, I'll get up and then I'll like read poetry on the couch. But
yeah.
Once I get up, I usually can't go back to sleep. So yeah, no. I don't read in the middle of the night.
Right. Now, so you have no relationship with nostalgia whatsoever.
Oh, I think I have a very rich and complicated relationship with nostalgia, but it's just not books. I'll watch old movies over and over again, but that's just 2 hours. You know what I mean? It's like.
So it's the immersive nature of it. It's not.
I think also like a movie is a very contained experience and you can get the feeling of watching that movie again.
Mm-hmm.
By watching it, and that just takes 2 hours. But like if you read a book over the course of, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, some of the feeling of having read that book is like embedded in whatever you were doing at the time and whatever other emotions you had, and that won't be recreatable just by reading it again. So like I frequently pull a book that I love off the shelf and find passages that I dog-eared or underline that I want to read again, like a paragraph or even a chapter. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. But yeah, I guess I just always feel like I'm not going to get the same feeling I got the first time I read it again, and so I almost don't want to try because there's this fear that I won't like it quite as much, or I'll notice something that's annoying that I didn't notice before. That
well, so is reading a leisure time thing, or I mean, are you always kind of on the clock?
I mostly read at night or like in the morning on the weekends. But I mean, it's leisure, and it's like I don't know. That's how I do good thinking, is by reading,
right.
It's a very intellectual and emotional experience. You know what I'm saying, Jeff?
I do know what you're saying. But no, but seriously, I mean, because one of the things, I mean, I've read your work, I guess, over like, when's your first, did it come out in 2011?
The French Exit?
Yeah. Did it come out in 2010?
2010, I think.
2010.
It's 2010.
That's
almost a decade ago.
I know that's almost a decade ago. I mean, that's a while. Well, I guess in the scheme of things, it's not that long, but.
Well, yeah.
It
feels like a long time.
Yeah, but I mean, do you, like, I remember when your husband, John, who you mentioned a lot in the word pretty, that you were not going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I remember that, but like, I guess because I followed your blog too, but I,
right.
That is one of the things that, and what was your rationale there?
I just didn't think there was any point. I thought that marriage was like this kind of outdated institution, and I just didn't see any reason to do it, aside from like these huge cultural pressures that didn't feel like they had anything to do with me because I'm not religious, and I wasn't like afraid that he was going to leave me, you know, or vice versa if we didn't have this like pact, this mm-hmm. legal pact. It just seemed like a lot of hullabaloo for like when we were already happy and living together and everything was fine. But what changed is that, you know, he got sick, he got this chronic illness and didn't have insurance and he couldn't get on my insurance unless we were married. And so it was very practical, pragmatic thing that we did. But then, I mean, because he was so sick at first, I did find that there were other kind of benefits to being married that I hadn't foreseen. Like, people took us more seriously as a couple. Like, it was easier for me to call his doctors and get test results and things like that. If I could say I'm his wife rather than, you know, I'm his girlfriend.
Or I'm his partner even?
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like people immediately gave you a pass. Like, and...
But, I mean, so this is in Boston and in Denver? This is wherever? Just societal?
Oh, just well, how I feel about marriage?
No, just acceptance. Like, no matter, yeah. Like, okay.
Yeah, I think for better or worse, like, most of the world just takes you more seriously as a couple if you're married. And so I did find that kind of, like, reified and reinforced our relationship in a way that I was like, oh, how could we possibly be more committed to each other than we already are? But, I mean, now it does feel like we are more committed to each other. So I was wrong about that. It's one of those things, like, you can't imagine what it's like to have kids if you don't have them or whatever.
You can't imagine to have kids if you don't. Yeah, I guess.
And then once you have them, you really can't remember what it was like not to have them in a way.
Right.
is what I hear. I don't have kids, but that's the impression I get. So, yeah, there were aspects to it that I hadn't foreseen or envisioned.
But it's not like you chide yourself for youthful thinking in that regard. It was more because he was sick.
Right.
And what did he have or what?
He has this rare condition called Meniere's disease, mm-hmm. which Jonathan Swift also had.
Your boy Jonathan Swift.
And it's like, can I say bad words?
We'll bleep them out later.
All right. Basically, your ears are just really fucked up. They don't really understand why. But so it causes sudden and fluctuating hearing loss and really, really wicked bad tinnitus that makes it really hard to sleep and it gives you anxiety and vertigo, dizziness. And, like, it, basically your ears are just totally hosed.
Came out of nowhere, kind of? Not married your family?
Yeah, kind of out of nowhere. I guess he always had some weird ear stuff, but it just suddenly got much, much worse, like, life-changing, debilitating, and now he's found ways to, like, work around it and live with it. But for a couple of years, it was like we were going around the country, you know, just to different doctors. And
oh, you were so because people couldn't figure out what it was, or they couldn't figure out.
Right, there was always the and I shouldn't talk about this so much because I feel like I'm like appropriating his story. but I'll just say, yeah, there was, you know, we kept seeing doctors who would kind of give us hope that, like, oh, it could be something curable. And so even if it was like a 1-5% chance, you're chasing that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we basically went down every possible avenue of what it could be. And finally, all that's left is like, yeah, it's probably this thing that nobody understands and nobody can cure. And we'll probably get worse over the years. But
right.
A lot of people find a way to live with it. And, you know, a lot of people are super miserable with it.
Right.
It kind of depends.
Sure. So when you hear something like NYC by Interpol, I mean, I think I'm a little bit. I'm 35.
Uh-huh.
But it seems to be such a song just locked in time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would never just put this on to kind of, like, cruise around.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't heard it in years.
Yeah.
My brother made me a mix CD. Like, remember when people used to do that?
I do.
You know, probably on... I think he probably had, like, an actual... Not even a laptop. Like, one of those computers in college where it's like... What did they call that? You know, it was like... CPU was like a tower.
I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, he made me this, like, double mix CD.
This is 2008. No.
Well, so I was, I mean, I was writing the poems in the French accent more in like 2005, 2006, 2000, I don't know, over a number of years. It's like your first book is like your first album, right? Like they're like all the good poems you've written so far, so whatever. So a lot of those were from, or some of them were from grad school or like the year or two right after grad school. So I was probably 2005, 2006. Maybe I was still in grad school even. But my brother made me this mix and I really loved it. And he like drew... like album art.
That, I mean, I used to do that all the time.
And, yeah, and I listened to it so much that like the CDs wore out. You know what I mean? Like they wouldn't play anymore. And then I think I lost them sadly. But this was one of the songs on that mix CD.
And but you were in Boston. I mean, one of the
I was in Boston. Yeah,
that you did. I mean, that you possibly wanted to. I felt trapped in Boston, fantasized about moving to New York, which seems always majestic or debased, never merely quaint. Do you have any longing to live in New York anymore?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Somewhat. It's like it's not as keen, that longing, but I mean, yeah, I've always sort of felt like yeah, that's a real city.
Well, sure.
In a way that like most other cities aren't. I love it. I love being there, but it's so unlivable. And so it seems kind of like there's this window in your youth where you're fine with being totally poor and broke all the time. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, I shouldn't say poor. I should say broke.
Like you romanticize that too, kind of?
Not really, but it was just like it would be acceptable. Whereas now I would not find it acceptable. Like I want to have... savings and
right.
Like money to spend when I want to spend it and not feel like I'm just pouring it all into an apartment that costs $4,000 a month or whatever. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think I've just gotten to a point where I don't accept the terms of living in New York. And I guess I never did, or I would have moved there at some point.
But you're from the East Coast.
No, people always think that. I'm from Texas.
You're from Texas.
Yes.
Okay, then I totally thought that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess because Boston, because Emerson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I moved there when I was 22, and I lived there for 10 years, so I was there for a long time.
Okay.
But I lived in Texas until I was 22.
Right. Where in Texas?
I grew up in El Paso.
Okay.
And then I went to college in Houston.
At the University of Houston?
At Rice University.
Rice University. Huh. Yeah, doesn't feel like you're from Texas. I'm not going to lie to you. So what'd your parents do?
My dad is an internist. He's a doctor. And my mother, when I was a kid, she worked in his office. And then a little bit later on, she went back to get a PhD in history. And so now she teaches at the University of Texas at El Paso. She has like kind of like a half lectures, half administrative job there.
Mm-hmm. What and siblings?
I have an older brother of the famous mix CD. Yeah.
How much older?
About 2.5 years. He went to the same college as me. So he was a senior when I was a freshman. And we had all the same friends for a year. It was really fun.
You interacted with one another? Well,
sister. We were good friends.
Are you okay? I'm not judging. When my sister was a junior, I was a freshman at Reno High, but she did not. I mean, I don't want to throw her under the bus. I love you, Jenny, but she wasn't really trying to hang out with me.
Yeah,
this was in college though. So he was a senior and you were a freshman, or this is high school.
Well, you know, yeah. And we didn't go to the same high school, but yeah, in college. But I mean, Rice is a really small school. It's a really, like, nerdy school, and we were both kind of nerdy, and, like, we had the same friend group, and we liked all the same stuff, and...
I thought Rice was big.
No, Rice is small.
Like,
it's small. It's, like, small, private...
3,000 small or 10,000 small?
More like 3,000. I can't remember off the top.
It is small.
Yeah.
Well, it's very well known then.
I think it's about 4,400 undergrads, something like that. That number comes to mind.
Oh, okay.
So like maybe 1,000 per class. I could be getting that wrong, but it's small.
Mm-hmm.
Like you knew most of the people, at least by sight in your class generally.
Oh. And then how big is El Paso?
El Paso's like somewhere between 500,000 and 750,000.
Okay.
People.
So it's, I mean, that's kind of like Portland.
Yeah.
Well, the metro
is
bigger, obviously.
It is, yeah.
But Portland itself,
it feels like about the same size, but less hip. But
wow.
Also, so it doesn't feel like the rest of Texas at all because it's like way at the very western tip. And like all the other famous Texas cities for the most part are kind of in the east, central east. So it feels much more like New Mexico. It's,
oh, really?
Like, yeah, my parents' house is like, you can walk to New Mexico from my parents' house.
Okay. I have no sense of Texas.
You can picture the shape, right?
Well, kind of.
So that point, like way over on the
is Texas
little tippy point.
Third in geography?
Yes. Alaska, California, Texas. Wait.
Alaska, California. Nevada's seventh. I'm from Nevada.
Actually, I can't remember if Texas or California is bigger.
But
it must,
it's just...
It must be. It's huge.
It's huge.
I think probably California is bigger. But it takes... I mean, I've driven from one tip to the other many times because El Paso to Houston. So it takes like 12, 13 hours solidly.
But you can do it in one day? No.
Yeah, if you can get up early and just go.
You can... No. You can drive across Texas in one day?
Yes. Well, yeah. Yeah, 12, 13 hours.
I don't think you've done it in a while. That seems too... I thought
it's
Texas...
No.
Texas seems so much bigger. I thought it was like a three-day thing.
Well, no, because, I mean, it's also from north to south really big, but just from one side to the other.
Yeah.
Here's a good trivia. So El Paso is like right in the middle between Houston and San Diego. So if you drive east all day, you get to the other side of Texas. If you drive west all day, you get to the west coast.
Hmm. I might seem dubious, but I believe you. I believe you. And so were your parents, I mean, did they kind of, was your brother a writer? I mean.
No.
None of them? No.
No. I mean, everyone in my family has like their little hobbies.
But I mean, this isn't a hobby, I don't think.
No.
Is it?
No. I mean, my mother, like I said, she has a PhD in history. So she was, for a little while, she was trying to make a book out of her dissertation. She kind of gave up on it because it was just overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
But
what specific section of history? Just all of it?
Kind of. she was interested in like borderlands history, kind of around the turn of the century, and medicalization. It's I'm honestly over my head because I know so little about history, but things like faux health scares that were meant to keep Mexican immigrants out of El Paso, like the medicalization of breastfeeding versus formula.
That's kind of interesting.
It is really interesting. Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting.
I mean, but so it was an intellectual household in a certain sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone in my family is super smart. I'm just, you know, the only... Well, then I don't want to say I'm the only writer because, it's just, you know, being a historian is a little different from being like a poet. But yeah. I mean, my brother was really good at drawing.
But you grew up, the intellect was kind of prized.
I was just like the biggest school nerd ever. Like I've gotten one non-A in my life. Like I got a B in computer science when I was a freshman in college, and it was devastating to me.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
gosh.
I was always like teacher's pet.
What about math?
I didn't really, I kind of, you know, abandoned math in college, but like,
but
I got like A pluses in calculus. Like
you got A pluses?
Yeah. Like school was really easy for me. I loved it. Like I was just like, I didn't even have to do my homework. I was just like, I just got it, which now makes no sense to me because I don't remember the first thing about calculus. Like I literally don't know what it is.
Well, yeah, no one really does. but did you ever push back as you got older? Kind of against the intellect to a certain degree?
Not really. I mean, I think I was a little, like, I wasn't super disciplined because school was easy for me. So, like, I feel like I just kind of sailed through school and even college because I would just, in college, I just studied stuff that was really fun for me. So it was easy. And I graduated early. And
You graduated early, too. Oh, so you were, okay, you're going for it. Well, I just was a mess up in college. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I wasn't like super bad, but yeah. I mean, it took me 4.5 years, so not really that long. Yeah. But I had no, I mean, what was your major? Always English?
Cognitive science and linguistics. So, and for a while I was thinking about going and getting a PhD in linguistics.
Oh.
Yeah, like I applied to programs and stuff, but then I ended up getting an MFA instead.
Right. And I mean, so you never really have, like, emotional intelligence. I mean, because one of the things as I've gotten older is, I mean, the work, I guess, in the word pretty, but also your poetry, that's the stuff that I kind of grasp onto, things that are analytical a lot of the times, things that are, you know, thought-driven. And I guess when I was younger, I would really kind of push away from things that seemed to not really, that seemed to be more based in just like feeling or more based in kind of like an insular kind of thing. But I did realize, you know, that those have their place too.
Right.
And I just wonder if my emotional intelligence as I get older was never really formed.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I guess I've always, I've been drawn to kind of like intellectualized emotion in poetry. So I mean, I feel like Sylvia Plath is like the perfect example of that because, you know, there's this real like exacting formality in her poems, but also they're super emotional. And yeah, I don't know. I like that it can be both.
Sure. All right. A song.
I hopped off the plane at LAX with a dream, my cardigan. Welcome to the land of fame, excess. Am I gonna fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the Hollywood sign. This is all so crazy. Everybody seems so famous. My tummy's turning and I'm feeling kinda homesick. Too much.
Your girl Miley Cyrus. So this is a karaoke song.
Yes.
Why?
Why? Wow. Wow.
I mean, I can read it. This is probably as tailor-made for karaoke as songs get, but slightly challenging. That whiny chorus really taxes old vocal cords. I mean, it's kind of surprising to me that you love karaoke.
I do really love karaoke, yeah. I guess I haven't analyzed it that much.
Because it's kind of a lack of I don't think of karaoke as a super like intellectual thing. It's a lack of inhibitions.
Definitely
sometimes.
Not. Yeah. I think like we don't really just acknowledge how fun it is to like sing
in
public.
Totally. Yeah. Like, and then you sing in the shower because you can't do it walking down the street because people think you're,
I mean, I just, like, if I hear a song on the radio and I know it, I sort of, like, automatically sing along. And it always blows my mind that some people don't.
Well, do you mean out loud or just in their heads?
Well, yeah, like, I do it out loud.
If you hear a song in the grocery store, you're going to sing out loud?
Often, yeah. I mean, I don't belt, like, at the top of my lungs. I'm just, you know, kind of singing under my breath to myself. But it feels just, like, automatic.
Whether you like the song or not?
No, only if I like it.
Well, because songs get stuck in your head that you revile. But
right. Then... Well, so, yeah, sometimes I accidentally find myself singing along with a Billy Joel song or whatever.
Yeah. I never got super into Billy Joel.
Oh, I hate Billy Joel.
Do you really?
So much. Oh.
Because
he doesn't have any good songs. They're just, it's just terrible music.
Piano Man.
That's awful.
Why is that no good?
Have you listened to it recently?
Not in a little bit. Because it's just like sentimental and maudlin.
Yeah, and just, I feel like nothing about his song sounds good. I should stop. Someone's going to send me hate mail.
Yeah, this is a lot of Billy Joel diehards.
Somebody
are listening
from Jersey
to
or...
He's from Jersey, right?
Oh, God, wait. Is that true?
I think he is. He's bald. He is bald. He's not very tall either.
No, but what does that have to do with Jersey?
I think between the lines, we both knew what I was getting at.
Wait, no. Yeah, I think he probably is, right?
He's definitely bald.
No, I think he's probably from New Jersey.
I'm pretty sure he's from New Jersey, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There's like a certain genre of people that really...
Scream Jersey?
That really, no, really like have some kind of nostalgic attachment to Billy Joel. But I've often, like, people have told me he's not that bad. And then I'm like, okay, play me a good song. And they'll try to find one. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, actually, that's pretty bad. Oh, yeah, actually, this is really bad. Like, if you actually listen to the song.
I mean, I never really have. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, they're bad. They're not good.
But Miley Cyrus is good.
I mean, well, I don't know her whole discography.
You don't know her whole catalog?
I know. Yeah, I mean, I know some of the as she would say, bangers.
Ooh, boom. Terminology.
But yeah, Party in the USA kicks ass. I mean, it's a great karaoke song.
Because it gets the crowd moving, it gets you moving. I mean, because this is very different than Patience by Guns N' Roses, which you said you did once, which is a great...
An amazing song.
But not a good karaoke song.
I mean, it's hard. It's a hard karaoke song because there's a lot of kind of like dead space.
Right.
It's just real quiet. And I'm not a good whistler, so I can't really do the whistle part, which is too bad.
They expect you to? I mean, do you have a favorite spot in Denver?
Yeah, there's this place called Barracuda. Barracuda? I think it's called Barracudas. I also think they misspelled Barracuda, but I can never remember what the right way to spell Barracuda is. But it's just like, it's very divey and the drinks are really cheap. And once, when I first moved to Denver, I went there with Julia Cohen. You know Julia Cohen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The poet, and she ordered a Greyhound. And so now every single time I go to Barracudas, I always order Greyhounds just because, I don't know. Do you have that where you associate a certain drink with a certain bar?
Yeah, I mean, totally.
So they're really cheap. You get like a $4 Greyhound, and they have karaoke like every weekend night, and it's really low-key, and it's never super crowded.
Right.
So you can go like three times. You know, like sometimes you can only go once. So you can do your old favorite and then that new song you want to try.
But I mean, you do think about it, kind of. Like, what am I, like, I mean...
If I know I'm going to do karaoke, I'm like, oh, what am I going to sing later? But it's purely for me, like, it's not like I want everyone to hear my great vocals. Like, I'm not a terrible singer, but I'm not a good singer. I just, like, find it pleasurable to sing loudly with other people around, and like I like singing along with other people when they're singing. The whole atmosphere of karaoke is just very like good vibes to me.
It's freeing.
It is. It's freeing, and it's like, but it's also, it's just so communal, you know? It's kind of like that. Like, I also love, this is something that's not in my life enough, like when you're literally sitting around a campfire and somebody has a guitar and like,
oh my, I think that's only happened a couple of times in my life, and I really scoffed at it.
No, it's, I mean, like, but don't imagine like the worst version ever, right? Like,
I can't help it. I like, just remember go on. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's super douchey lame versions of it, but like,
well, yeah.
I, in Boston, I used to live on this little like kind of dead end street, and the people next door to us had lived in their place forever, and they always had a solstice party. And they would like have a, you know, like a bonfire outside, and it was just like a neighborhood party, but you know, they were kind of older and their kids were like in high school maybe.
New agey people?
Not really. Like ex-hippies, you know, they just like listen to NPR all day.
Okay.
Do I
sound too judgy? I mean, I'm sure they're
not. A little.
Okay, go on.
Practice tolerance. But we went, you know, they just had like food and drinks and like a bunch of people like who lived on the street and like their old friends and their kids' friends or whatever. And like there was like a sort of woo-woo ritual at some point where like there was a stick that we passed around and then we had to like...
It's getting weirder.
I know. It was that part was weird. I don't remember what we did. We had to like make some kind of like wish for the...
Are people doing marijuana?
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know. Yeah. I didn't.
A wish stick is going around and then a guitar appears.
But it's like a normal party. Like it wasn't like cultish.
It doesn't sound cultish so much as
But yeah, at some
LA-M-y.
Point, like the couple's kid like got out his guitar. And I mean, but we weren't singing like Kumbaya. Like we were singing like Psycho Killer. But
somebody was playing acoustic guitar Psycho Killer?
Yeah.
I'm more open to that, but...
But the point was, like, there's this communal spirit of, like, singing even, like, with strangers or near strangers. Like, it makes you feel like you're friends, you know? And, like, there was a recent time that I did karaoke and there were these kids that were, like, a little younger than me and the friend I was with. And they were only doing, like, the greatest hits of the 90s.
Well, yeah, because the 90s are back.
Yeah. And like they were just
Nirvana
so
or like In Vogue?
Neither. No, more like...
TLC, Waterfalls?
Like late 90s pop, like...
NSYNC?
Well, actually, no, maybe like Alanis Morissette into...
Ooh, Jagged Little Pill.
Yep. And to say... I guess it was going into the early 2000s too, like The Killers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was clearly like the music from their childhood or...
Oh, they were older.
No, they were younger.
They were younger.
Right. So, I mean, that's... Like childhood as opposed to like I was a teenager and
right and they were 90s. Like eight
right
okay
I think you know
sure
yeah but it was like the stuff that was popular when I was a teenager seemed kind of lame you know but it was like they thought about those 90s songs the way that I feel about like 80s songs which like
right.
I feel like 80s pop is like great and unassailable it doesn't seem like cheesy or corporate to me I'm just like what's fucking great
well, right I was just talking with someone about Huey Lewis in the news
I love Huey Lewis
well,
you
right.
know Huey Lewis has Meniere's disease
are you being serious
I'm totally dead serious Huey Lewis and
John Cotter
yeah and Ryan Adams I'm pretty sure
Oh, really?
I think they all have Meniere's
disease.
Oh,
okay.
I think you can get it from like eardrum damage or whatever. So
right.
It's not uncommon for musicians. But or maybe it's just their well-known cases because they had to like I know Huey Lewis had to like stop touring because he couldn't hear shit.
Right. But I mean, yeah, I think when I think of Huey Lewis, I guess if I was older I'd be like this is still lame, but now I kind of like, yeah, it's awesome, you know. I want a new drug, you know.
Yeah. I mean, lame in such a good way.
Is community a big deal for you outside of karaoke? I guess I'm thinking of Twitter. Like, I mean.
Yeah.
And even your blog back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, is that something that, because some people are kind of more isolated geniuses.
which I respect. Yeah, I mean, I work from home, so I'm alone a lot, and I have to be online. So, I've just always had this inclination to like try to find people to talk to online about stuff that I want to talk about. So like I used to do that with my blog. Like I would post about whatever dumb thing I was thinking about and people would comment on it. It was sort of like slow community.
Right. But it did. I mean, has that impacted kind of your own writing?
Which part?
Well, I mean, I think you've talked in essays before about Twitter being condensed and how it's the best.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say in the word pretty? Do you have your whole entire au revoir memorized?
No, but probably something about it being aphoristic.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I think it's gotten less aphoristic since they expanded the character limit. And but I also feel like now that people thread tweets, so 280 characters and you can thread them, that people basically write a blog post on Twitter. And yeah, that's totally not the way that people used to use it. I mean, it's changed a lot.
But I mean, you are all, and I remember this too, you were not going to be on Facebook.
I've never been on.
Well, yeah, it was Facebook, just like a thing, I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wrote a blog post about why I'm not on Facebook and a blog post about why I didn't want to get married.
I think, and I read your blog. So why? I mean, is it just kind of Facebook was? Why didn't you want to do Facebook? Because that's back in the day, it was more community.
Right. I remembered. There were a bunch of those, like before Facebook became the only one that did that thing. There were like three or four others.
Like MySpace, like, you mean?
But even before that, there
Friendster?
Was Friendster. Were you on Friendster?
No.
Yeah.
But I know about it.
So I was never on any of those. And I don't know. I just didn't. But I mean, at the time of those, I wasn't on Twitter either. You know, I didn't have any kind of like social media per se.
But this is like 06?
Like when I was in college and grad school or whatever.
Yeah, so then
so I would periodically get like invited to, you know, one of these things, and I just always thought it seemed stupid, so I was just like not an early adopter or whatever. And then when I sort of slowly realized that like it was like everyone but me had been assimilated.
Well, but
like initially it just seemed like, oh, you can do that or not do that, it doesn't matter. Like it took me a while to sort of figure out like, oh, literally everybody is on this Facebook thing except for me.
But you knew, you knew that too, right? I mean, do you kind of go against the established norm sometimes?
I guess I just didn't feel like it was something that was missing from my life. So yeah, right. There's other, I mean, I was kind of like slow to get like a smartphone and use apps because for a long time I was like, I don't need that in my life.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, now I do feel like, oh, I do need apps in my life, but
I do need apps in my life.
But I have never felt like I need Facebook in my life, except for maybe when I first moved to Denver, because I realized people would invite each other to poetry readings or whatever through Facebook.
It's like that's the only reason.
So I didn't know about anything that was going on. It was kind of hard to make friends at first, but I just stuck it out. I don't know.
I mean, Twitter does show up a decent amount in the word pretty. I mean,
yes,
not necessarily. You're not just talking about the mechanics of Twitter, but you ask questions, people respond. I mean, it is kind of. So, I mean, do you ever get burned out on that? I mean, I think you have a lot. I'm not on Twitter.
Good for you.
Because you like it. Have said that too.
I used to like it a lot more, but like in the post-Trump world, it's
successful.
A lot of it is successful, yeah, for sure. I mean, but so is Facebook. I mean, I don't know.
It's even worse, I'd say.
Yeah, like, ugh. I mean, yeah, I think that I'm actually just kind of, I'm pretty good at like avoiding political rabbit holes. Like
on social media generally?
Yeah, like I don't follow people on Twitter who only tweet about politics. I still see it, but I'm mostly like, you know, there are people who still care about, you know, writing and books and
right. No, there's
those
a lot
the
of
people
those.
That
yeah,
I
yeah.
interact with. Yeah. And, but I mean, but also for like, you know, 6 months after the 2016 election, like when I went back and looked, like I was tweeting about Trump all the time because it was just like, it just felt so overwhelming. Like, how could you see around it? And it was super depressing, but I was also kind of like, well, but we should be depressed. Like we should be paying attention to this terrible thing that's going on. Like we don't like deserve to be distracted and happy. We should like.
But do you wish you'd censored yourself because you weren't saying anything like kind of bringing anything new to the conversation?
No, I don't wish that. But I think that's why I kind of stopped tweeting about politics so much, is because it really did feel like I'm not bringing it. Like somebody else is always going to say it. And I would like, it was not very substantive. Like I was just kind of talking about my emotions at the time because they were really overwhelming and,
right.
But yeah, now it's just kind of like, there's just the evil and the stupidity is just so constant all the time. And somebody else is always talking about it. And like, it does sort of feel like I have nothing to add. And like, it just seems so incredibly low value for me to like throw my 2 cents into the ring of like, yes, this is all still really incredibly upsetting and stupid. So I just kind of stopped.
But you do elicit, I mean, it seems like, again, I'm not on it, but I mean that you do get people who are interested in cool things via Twitter. I mean, people, you tweet a lot. I mean, you tweet every day?
Almost, yeah. And I mean, if I'm really busy traveling, nothing
But so
nothing interesting occurs to me. I might not, but yeah, almost every day.
And you've never, I mean, it's enjoyable.
Mostly, yeah.
Because, and people also, I mean, as you've kind of grown in stature as a writer, I mean, more people follow you and.
Yeah, I mean, net positive for me. I've made a lot of writing friends and met like editors that I went on to work with. And like, it's been good for my life for sure. It's just, but like, I totally understand why anybody would not want to do it. And I think I'm still under the threshold of like, I don't have a lot of trolls.
Right.
And like, I do have stupid at replies that annoy me. But it's not at this point where it's just like, this makes me want to kill myself every time I tweet something. Why am I doing this? You know?
Right.
But I think if I had twice or three times as many Twitter followers, it would probably be at that point where it feels not really worth it. But, you know, I mean, the new people find you that way. And it
well,
gets
no,
your
a lot of people.
There.
I mean, that's the French, your blog back in the day was how I kind of discovered you. But I mean, it's interesting just to me that every time I say I'm not on Twitter, somebody who does have enjoyable experiences is still like, good for you. Like, because you're not, well, I mean, I'm not.
Right. Well, because if you've never done it, you can't miss it. So it's like, I mean, that's the same thing. I know so many people are like, it would be so hard for me to get off Facebook completely because there's people in my family that like, that's the only way we keep in touch. And,
yeah.
But for me, nobody has ever been able to find me on Facebook. So if I quit, I mean, I can't quit because I was never there. but there's nothing for me to like miss, you know, like it never became part of my daily existence. So
sure.
But like I would miss Twitter if I quit because there are positive things I'm getting from it that I wouldn't know how to recreate elsewhere.
Right. Okay. Let's do another song.
I don't know why I let go. I want to be your friend. Flowers grow through my window, and I love you again. Oh, I love you. Oh, when you laid me down into your beautiful garden. Flowers and the love of mine is God shining through to me, I guess. It's God shining through to me, I guess. Oh, I love you.
Ryan Adams, Amy, Heartbreaker. What's your take on Ryan Adams?
Oh, God. So I think when you first asked me, oh, yo, you're gonna be in Portland, you want to come talk to me about music, I think it was pretty shortly after that that this kind of Ryan Adams expose came out, and it really kind of like gut punched me. I don't know.
Oh, really? You were that big a fan of his?
I love Ryan Adams.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
I don't love him as a person.
Right.
Not, I don't know that I never paid that much attention to him as a person, but now certainly I'm like, I thought, yeah, I was sickened because I'm like, that's going to ruin, or if not ruin, I don't know. I don't know if it'll ruin it, but it certainly taints his music for me completely. And, yeah, so I was just kind of thinking like, shit, like, how do you talk about music without feeling like, yeah, part of me was like, oh, we should only talk about, you know, women artists because then I don't have to
right.
worry about promoting someone that I'm going to find out the next day is a rapist or, you know, an abuser. Although, you know, of course, women can be abusers too. So, but it just, yeah, it just made me feel like sick and so fraught. And it does, like, it taints something that I had liked. And, you know, it's, of course, something we all deal with. Like, if you love Michael Jackson. Like, I do love Michael Jackson, but, you know, also he's a horrible person.
I mean, do things like, you know, separating the art versus the artist, I mean, in the 21st century, 2019, does that seem to be an old kind of statement that doesn't really apply nowadays?
Well,
I mean, can you separate them?
I can, to some extent, separate it for people from, like, the deep past, you know.
But like Ezra Pound was an asshole. Why? Right. Why? I mean, how? Just because it came before your time?
Well, I mean, like I don't have any attachment to Ezra Pound.
Okay,
so that's hard. That's not the best hypothetical for me. But it's more like it's harder for me to, if it's somebody who's like actively practicing their art and like being an asshole to real people right now and like keeping women, say, out of spaces where they might succeed if it weren't for this powerful asshole keeping them out of it. You know, then it becomes more inextricable, less extricable. And our universe, like, I don't know. I just sort of hate Hollywood in general. So like, I don't personally ever feel like, oh, but I love that one director's work. And like, how am I going to deal with the fact that I, you know, found out that he's a bad person? Because I just sort of think like the whole Hollywood system is totally corrupt and disgusting, and so
right.
I just basically hardly ever see movies. But it's
but in the deep past, because some things were like culturally embedded that you can kind of
in the deep past, everything, almost everything and everyone was bad. But I also also think right now, like, everyone and everything is bad. So it's like I think that we're going to look terrible to the future. You know what I mean? Like,
because we have like smartphones that use minerals that are, I mean,
oh, for so many reasons. Yeah, I mean, like, we're very self-righteous, but like, you know, we live in America, and yeah, the smartphones are a perfect example. We enjoy so many things. Like, we fly everywhere. We don't give a shit how much oil we're using, and just our entire way of life is like so unsustainable and is going to come crashing down very soon. And like, but we're so like, we're like oblivious to that. We just keep doing it anyway. And yet we're all very self-righteous and like, but not even about condemning other people that are alive now, but also condemning people from 10, 20 years ago. It's just like, but we suck too. Like,
well, right. But I mean, cause
we're awful. We're awful. And, but we still make art, you know?
No, but I mean, that's interesting because, like, you think 100 years ago, gosh, things were sure different. Like, we really, I think subconsciously a lot of people, like, we've made a lot of progress, which I think is...
We have.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which I think is true. I mean, but at the same time, in 50 years, people are going to look back and be like, gosh, they'd had no idea, like...
Well, like, just 5 years ago was so different. I mean, I was just...
Yeah.
I was talking to somebody yesterday about like remembering the blog HTML Giant.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was so like toxic and hostile to women.
HTML like in 2013, 2014.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah, when it was around. And like I wrote for them sometimes, and you know, everybody read it, and we just accepted that for the most part. Like there were like a few lone dissenters who were like, "This sucks. Why does it have to be this way?"
It was just misogynistic on there.
Oh, completely. Yeah, I mean, like all the they didn't moderate the comments at all, and so like all the comments were men, and like if somebody said something like, "Oh, this is kind of offensive" or whatever, they would just get piled on. And I mean, but the point is I remember very clearly how just feeling like this is so hostile to women, and like everyone's basically accepting it, and like I feel like already now, you know, just a few years later, like, people would not accept that.
So
like the sort of moral standards have gotten higher, tighter that quickly, just in the writing world, and you know, in other arts spaces too. I mean, this kind of Me Too thing is happening and all these different artistic realms. But I just feel like the mores change very, very quickly.
But 50 years from now or 10 years from now, you think that there will still be...
Well, the thing is, they don't always get better. It's not like,
right.
You know, like the 50s were terrible for women. In some ways, like the 20s were better. You know, like it's just, I feel like it's very up and down. And just this, I don't understand the assumption that like we have reached some kind of peak of morality that like will not, like that will be unassailable to future generations or even like our kids or
sure.
But
I think of you as an optimist, I guess.
Oh,
like a closet optimist. I mean, I don't think of you. I mean, I have friends who I consider, yeah. And I'm maybe one I consider like are cynical. You don't seem very cynical. Or at least your writing isn't cynical. I mean,
yeah, I don't. Yeah, I don't. I don't think I'm cynical, but I'm a little bleak on the future of humanity. I gotta say.
Well, I think a lot of people are. how many more years do you think we'll have?
I mean, the question is, how many more will we have? Like, that feel, you know, recognizable. Like, I think, you know, so after the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs hit,
right?
There were still dinosaurs around for like tens of thousands of years,
maybe even more. Right?
It was like the beginning of the end, but it's not like they all instantly died, which is like kind of the fantasy, right? Like,
oh, sure, that's what it is.
Instant annihilation sounds pretty good, but like I think, you know, humans will be around for a long time. I just think
it'll be very
sad,
different.
Utter destruction. Yeah, there will be so much suffering and death, and like. You know, libraries will be destroyed, you know, in fires and floods. And like, it just, the loss will be just staggering. So, yeah, I'm already like, I'm afraid to move to a coast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's scary. It's scary on the edges.
But you don't live a fearful life. I mean, you look forward to your next book coming out and you look forward to your breakfast, right? I mean, it's not like you're a.
Yes.
What are they called? Preppers?
Right. Yeah. Well. And yeah. I mean, I know someone who lives in Seattle, and she has a go bag because.
Oh, really?
You know the earth, like the earthquake that they think there might be a really huge.
Yeah.
Seattle earthquake. But I mean, and a lot of people have those, just, you know, regardless wherever they live. So I don't. I admit, but I'm in like a relatively low disaster.
Denver.
Yeah. Disaster zone. But I do feel like when I'm thinking about planning. 5, 10, 20 years ahead, I do sort of think, like, I don't know what things are going to be like then.
And does that change the way you've lived your life? Or live your life, I guess? I mean, big decisions, small decisions?
Yeah, I just feel like there's more contingency. Like, so just really long-term decisions, like, oh, you know, buying a house or having a kid or whatever. Like, I definitely changes the way. I don't feel like, oh, we can just operate the way every generation before us operated.
Oh, so you shied away from some of those things because of the world.
Yeah, because it's just, it feels like the burden of responsibility is suddenly much greater and maybe too great.
Sure. Yeah, my sister just had a kid. And I don't know, it's interesting. Some people think a lot about that and some people... that doesn't enter their framework at all, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just interesting how you can kind of, like, in your own mental dichotomy, kind of figure out what, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that...
Because I have another... Sort of, yeah, go on.
Like, the archetype for human life is just, it's very deep. Like, it's just, every story we've ever read is about, like, people having kids, you know?
Well, right. So, like, yeah, it's ingrained again.
Yeah. So it just... It just really seems like we should be able to keep doing what humans have been doing for thousands and thousands of years. Like, why should that suddenly stop?
Things are no good. Well, on that positive note, do you want to end by reading a little something from The Word Pretty or something else?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a request?
Well, no.
Okay. Do you want me to try to read a whole essay or just a few paragraphs?
You know, whatever you want to... Yeah, I mean, whatever you want to do. I can give you a request if you want one.
That's all right. I think maybe I'll just read part of this essay about crying.
Okay.
I like to ask people if they remember the last time they cried. Since I rarely go a week without crying at least a little, I always remember... The last time I cried was during the finale of the most recent season of Top Chef. I was happy or proud that a woman had won. Can you be proud of a stranger? My eyes filled with tears. They ran down my cheeks. I wiped them away. It was quick, silent crying. The last time I cried before that was after getting off the phone with my gynecologist receptionist and learning that I could not, at my approaching appointment, get my IUD replaced. The approaching appointment would be a LEAP procedure to electrosurgically remove several layers of precancerous cells from my cervix. during the cervical biopsy I'd undergone a couple of weeks before. The nurse practitioner had accidentally yanked my IUD out with her comically huge biopsy scissors. She left the device sitting in the sink in a small pool of blood, then left the room so I could get dressed again. I hadn't cried then, or when she told me I needed the leap, but I cried knowing that I'd have to go back once again to get a new IUD and be subjected for the third time in a month to the humiliation of lying flat on my back, naked from the waist down, with my legs in stirrups. I've often wished gynecological exam tables were as well designed as dentist chairs. This was a noisier, more intense cry, but equally brief. Had my husband, John, been awake, I might have drawn it out a little longer. But I was alone, so I sobbed with efficiency. I have noticed that there's something about speech that can trigger tears. I'll hear a story and know intellectually that the story is sad, but I won't actually cry until I tell it to someone else. Is it the speech act itself or the presence of an audience? In college, I learned that a girl from my high school, someone I knew but hadn't kept in touch with, had been in a bad car accident. Her right arm was severed off. I was shocked when I heard it, but not sad exactly. Later, I repeated the story to my mother. I remember we were driving at the time, and I was in the passenger seat, as the girl would have been. I started crying when I said the word severed, which had not seemed quite so brutal in my head as it did in my mouth. It's not often we have cause to say the word severed. Several years ago, my friend Kevin's wife, Katie, was almost crushed when a gallery wall fell on top of her. Her pelvis was shattered. She has said she didn't recognize the animal scream that came out of her. When Kevin called their families to tell them what had happened, he couldn't get it out. He'd try to speak and start sobbing. More than once, mentioning the story offhand to someone else, I've gotten unexpectedly choked up, like I can only realize how close she came to being killed or paralyzed when I'm vocalizing it. The writer Lee Stein once told me that she cried when she learned what Timothy McVeigh's last meal was, 2 pints of mint chocolate chip ice cream. "That's exactly what I would eat," she said. This would be her trigger if she needed to cry for a scene. I find the details of last meals almost unbearably poignant. Carla Faye Tucker's last meal request was a peach, a banana, and a garden salad with ranch dressing. Ranch dressing. She was executed in Texas, which no longer honors last meal requests. This infuriates me. When I questionnaire myself in the style of Proust, the answer to what would you think about if you needed to cry on cue changes every few years. Once, on a Sunday night in Boston, I had to take John to the ER with food poisoning. While we were waiting in the triage area, a man and a woman, an old couple, were rolled in on gurneys. They'd been in an accident. The woman was wordlessly moaning, and the man kept saying, "Where's my wife? I want to talk to my wife." Someone finally responded, "She's right over there. She can hear you." And he called out, "I'm sorry." Then they rolled the woman off into surgery, presumably, while the man continued to say, "Where's my wife? I want to be near my wife." He couldn't turn his head because of a brace around his neck. They finally rolled him away, too. It felt like a hospital scene in a movie. A horrific, if scripted, glimpse into the lives of strangers. In a movie, however, it wouldn't have been sad, merely horrific, since you'd have no attachment to these minor characters. As it is, it's one of the saddest things I've ever seen. John was lying on one of those shitty hospital beds, nauseated and dehydrated beyond belief, but I'd started crying, and he was comforting me. I have always hated Sundays. Everything seems worse on Sunday nights, just like everything seems worse when you wake up at 3 a.m., each obligation and annoyance in your life a heavier burden. The worst kind of tears are frustration tears, when you cross the can't-take-it-anymore threshold for some usually trivial reason, an inaccurate medical bill or horrible customer service agent. I'd rather cry from physical pain than frustration, though I can't remember the last time I was injured badly enough to cry. I cried a little when I sprained my ankle doing long jump in high school, but I've never broken a bone. When I was 26, I got 13 stitches in my chin after fainting toward a French door and breaking a pane of glass with my face. Amazingly, this did not hurt at all. Not at the time when I was unconscious, and not later, at any point during the stitching up or removal of stitches. The lack of pain and the fact that I didn't actually experience the fall makes the memory cinematic. I picture it happening from the vantage point of the bed in the room. I see me stumble from the bathroom to the French door and down to the hardwood floor, where I later woke up or was shaken awake. Men can't stand to see women cry, in the same way that parents can't stand to see their children cry. We learn the value of performative crying at a very young age. I suspect all women, if not all men, have snuck a look in the mirror while crying. Rearview mirrors, restaurant bathroom mirrors. A woman must continually watch herself, John Berger writes in Ways of Seeing. While she is walking across a room or while she is weeping at the death of her father, she can scarcely avoid envisaging herself walking or weeping. I've found that looking in the mirror is a very good way to stop crying. So just as you can never see yourself in the mirror with your eyes closed, you can never watch yourself weeping in the mirror. Instead, you see how you look just after.
Darn. Thank you, Elisa.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.